1892. He was the youngest of four children in a Jewish family that had emigrated from Russia. His young life did not predict fame, fortune, or even moderate competence. He dropped out of high school and spent time in a juvenile penitentiary as a teenager. In his 20s, he finally got steady work selling mink hats in Nebraska. Kamen quickly proved himself to be a preternaturally gifted salesman, even though his physical appearance was, on a good day, unsightly. He was a stocky gentleman with a broad face, squashed nose, round eyeglasses, and a severe middle part bisecting his thick black hair. Even his colleagues did not rise to his defense on this count. "Kay Kamen was one of the homeliest men I had ever seen," Jimmy Johnson, a Disney veteran, wrote in his memoir. "But looks are only skin deep. Kay was one of the warmest, most charming persons I ever met." In his 30s, Kamen found success at a Kansas City marketing firm where he specialized in developing products based on movies. His ambitions stretched westward. In 1932, he saw a Mickey Mouse cartoon and recognized that the mouse could be a star outside the Cineplex. He placed a call to Walt and Roy Disney in Los Angeles with a simple request. "Let me sell your cartoon mouse." The Disney brothers invited Kamen to drop by their Hyperion Avenue lot the next time he happened to find himself in Los Angeles. About 48 hours later, Kay Kamen was sitting in Walt's office. He had, by one account, cashed in his life savings, sewn the bills into his suit jacket, and boarded a 2-day westbound train. For fear that somebody might steal his jacket, he did not sleep for the entire 40-plus hour voyage. Kamen presented his plan to sell Mickey. Kamen's philosophy was that Disney needed to move Mickey Mouse out of the 10-cent store and into the department store, because that's where consumers were moving, said Thomas Tombush, perhaps the nation's leading researcher on Disney merchandising history. Kamen signed to become solely responsible for licensing Disney character merchandising worldwide. Kamen's winning insight was simple and somewhat Cassandran. Hollywood thought that toys were advertisements for movies. Hollywood was wrong. The opposite was true. The films were proofs of concept. The future of the movie business was everything outside the movie theater. In particular, the future of movies was in stores. Families were streaming from farms to cities, and the stores followed. In 1920, there were no Sears department stores in the United States. By 1929, there were 300. Annual sales of Disney merchandise went from $300,000 in 1930 to $35 million in 1935. Kamen's most famous achievement was the Mickey Mouse watch, which made its international debut at the Chicago World Fair in 1933. This was the nadir of the Great Depression. The U.S. economy had shrunk by a third since the late 1920s, and unemployment screamed past 20%. Many families hardly had the means to buy food in 1933, much less toys. But the Mickey Mouse watch was an instant and astonishing hit. Its manufacturer, the Ingersoll Waterbury Company, was rescued from the verge of bankruptcy by Horology, increasing the number of its factory workers from 300 to about 3,000 within the year to keep up with demand. Macy's landmark New York City department store sold 11,000 Mickey watches in one day. In 2 years, Disney sold more than 2 million. The watch was then the greatest financial success in the history of the Walt Disney Company, and it wasn't even Walt Disney's idea. Kamen infested the world with cartoon rodents. The New York Times described a pop culture landscape bustling with Mickey Mouse soap, candy, playing cards, bridge favors, hairbrushes, chinaware, alarm clocks, and hot water bottles wrapped in Mickey Mouse paper tied with Mickey Mouse ribbon and paid for out of Mickey Mouse purses. The Cleveland Plain Dealer described an idyllic child in 1935. In his room, Bordered with Mickey Mouse wallpaper and lighted with Mickey Mouse lamps, his Mickey Mouse alarm clock awakens him, providing his mother forgets. Jumping from his bed where his pajamas and the bedding are the Mickey Mouse brand to a floor, the rugs and linoleum upon which are Mickey Mouse sponsored, he puts on his Mickey Mouse moccasins and rushes to the bathroom to the soap made in the Disney manner, as are also his toothbrush, hairbrush, and towels. It is strange now to imagine Mickey Mouse as a symbol of anything but innocent charm and harmless rambunctiousness. But abroad, he was a complex symbol, both beloved as art and derided as propaganda. The Soviets claimed he symbolized the pathetic timidity of the capitalist workforce, while the Russian movie director, Sergei Eisenstein, praised Disney's work as the greatest contribution of the American people to art. In Nazi Germany, a similar divide opened between public derision and private delight. Mickey Mouse is the shabbiest, miserablest ideal ever invented, declared one Nazi propaganda newspaper in 1931. But Adolf Hitler must not have hated the character as much as he let on. In December 1937, 3 months before the invasion of Austria, the Nazi leader received 18 Mickey Mouse films as his Christmas present. Incredibly, the gift was from Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda. Back in Los Angeles, Kamen's Empire of Fantasy gave Walt Disney the confidence to make the first full-length animated film in history, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Without Kay Kamen, Tumbush said, there would be no Snow White. When the movie came out in December 1937, its reception was nothing short of rapturous, not just among children, but also among the industry's most discerning grown-ups. Charlie Chaplin, who attended the world premiere, declared Dopey, the dwarf, one of the greatest comedians of all time. Within a few years, it became Hollywood's highest-grossing sound film. Still, the movie's box office couldn't keep pace with Kamen's juggernaut. In the 2 months after its 1938 premiere, the movie made $2 million from the sale of toys. More than the actual film made in the United States that entire year. There were Snow White caramels, coloring books, candy boxes, cookingware, Christmas tree ornaments, carnival chalk figures, combs, crafts, and crayon sets. And that's just the merchandise starting with the letter C. Nobody in the film industry or beyond had ever seen something like this before. A film slipping off the silver screen and promiscuously impressing itself on every product category imaginable. The picture has virtually developed a new industry from its byproducts, the New York Times hailed in an editorial from May 1938. The Times predicted that Disney had invented a new business, industrialized fantasy, that could save the U.S. economy from the Great Depression. They were wrong. Industrialized fantasy was not the future of the economy. It was, however, the future of entertainment. Disney had developed the perfect movie merchandising symbiosis. Snow White, produced with the profits from Kamen's licensing business, poured fresh fuel right back into his merchandising machine. The movies inspired the toys, and the toys paid for the movies. Disney might not have been a born businessman, but he absorbed Kamen's lesson. The art of film is film, but the business of movies is everywhere. Disney described the strategy as total merchandising. A movie was more than a movie. It was also a shirt, a watch, a game, and soon, a television show. In the 1940s, much of Hollywood greeted the dawn of television as newspaper publishers did, by shielding their eyes and waiting for it to go away. Disney, however, saw television for what it could be, a movie theater in every living room and a living room advertisement for the movies. For several years, he wanted to build an amusement park, a Disneyland for children, based on his animated characters. He was also interested in developing a television show for one of the major broadcast networks. The stroke of genius was to unite these two dreams. He told his brother Roy to sell a Disney TV series to a network only if it was willing to invest in his park, too. NBC bought. CBS, too. But ABC, the runt of the big three broadcasters, jumped at the idea. In 1952, it agreed to make a Disney TV show and to invest in one-third of the park. In a move deemed one of the most influential commercial decisions in post-war American culture, Disney insisted that the television show and the park have the same name. Disneyland. Disneyland, the show, became the first ABC program to appear among the year's 10 highest-rated programs. About 40% of the nation's 26 million TV households tuned in each week, even though it was often little more than an advertorial or a sneaky blend of original content and advertising. One episode, Operation Undersea, provided a behind-the-scenes look at the film 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea just 1 week before Disney released it in theaters, an elaborate movie preview. The film went on to be the second highest-grossing movie of 1954, after White Christmas. Never before have so many people made so little objection to so much selling, one ABC executive said of the Disneyland television show. Disney's strategy also benefited from a demographic windfall. His key market was children sitting in front of the television, and in the post-war baby boom, the number of kids between 5 and 14 grew by 60% between 1940 and 1960. On July 17th, 1955, the Disneyland theme park opened. It was such a disaster that employees referred to it as Black Sunday. Several of the rides didn't work. There weren't enough water fountains to serve the attendees due to an earlier plumber's strike. 100-degree heat melted the fresh asphalt, which clung to the heels of mothers like octopus ink from Ursula's lair. But first impressions aren't everything. In its first 6 months, 1 million paying customers passed through Disneyland's gates, and the park accounted for one-third of the company's revenue for the year. ABC had made the park possible, but several years after it opened, the network sold its stake back to Disney. In retrospect, this was a horrifyingly bad idea, not unlike selling a band of rebels the weapons they'll eventually use to sack your city. In 1995, the Walt Disney Company bought ABC for $19 billion, with many thanks to the profits from the very amusement park business that ABC had once financed. By mid-century, the Walt Disney Company was no longer a movie business. Even in the 1950s, the studios produced stories that reached their largest audience through television. Disneyland, the show, constructed a mythology that families could truly inhabit only at Disneyland, the amusement park, which made much of its profit thanks to something else, the sale of Disney merchandise. The Disney empire is predicated on the principle that audiences both want to lose themselves in a fairy tale and map their lives onto it. One might cynically say that Disney's movies are proofs of concept for TV shows, which are advertisements for its theme park, which serves as a loss leader for capturing merchandising sales. But really, there is no unidirectional line of commercialization. Disney's empire is an Ouroboros, an infinite nostalgia loop in which everything is selling everything else. Like the future of the world economy itself, Disney's ambitions stretch eastward. The company's most important new creation isn't a new movie for America, but an amusement park for China. Shanghai Disney Resort, which opened in 2016, is a $5.5 billion project that was 25 years in the making. 300 million Chinese people, about 90% of the population of the United States, live within a three-hour commute of the park by car or train. Just as Disneyland was about more than selling tickets, Shanghai Disney Resort isn't just about theme park revenue or even selling merchandise on the park grounds. It's about building an infinity loop of awareness around Disney movies and products in China. As Walt did with Disneyland in the 50s, enabling Disneyland to really grow the Disney brand in the United States, we believe we will have some really interesting opportunities to do the same in China, Disney CEO Bob Iger said in 2009. The Walt Disney Company is the quintessential hit empire for three commercial reasons. First, with its television and marketing channels, it has great power to build exposure and awareness for its new and riskiest art. Second, the company is rich enough to buy the most popular franchises in the world, like Star Wars and Marvel, and produce lavish, familiar surprises with new chapters of old stories. Third, it converts happy audiences into high-paying devotees at its amusement parks and stores. Children, ages 4 through 120, are invited to own the fantasies that Disney has conjured, and the dolls, bedsheets, and costumes they bring into their homes become the most powerful advertisement for the next installment of the fantasy. Umberto Eco called Disneyland the quintessence of consumer ideology because it not only produces illusion, but also stimulates the desire for it. This is one future of hits. Total merchandising. Disney is larger, more influential, and more ever-present than any company could have been in 1932 when Kay Kamen arrived by train in Los Angeles and proposed to turn Mickey Mouse into a watch. But it still operates by a business philosophy that is pure Kamen. Every channel of distribution is an opportunity for exposure and commerce. Far beyond the darkness of a movie theater, Disney stories inhabit cable and broadcast television, its movies stream on Netflix, its franchise films cover billboards and taxis every year, and 8 of its amusement parks attract at least 10 million annual visitors. Disney's empire expands even to the stage, that most ancient and beautiful arena of entertainment. 18 years after the debut of the musical version of The Lion King, its productions have grossed more than $6.2 billion worldwide, more than any film, with more than 85 million tickets sold. Total merchandising is powerful not only because it pushes a company's content through all available channels, but also because companies can pull insights from these same channels. BuzzFeed, a young media company that might have the best chance to become a Disney for the 21st century, was born as a website. But like Disney, it is like a promiscuous vine that can live and grow in any climate. In 2016, 80% of BuzzFeed's audience discovered its content somewhere other than its website. On social networks like Facebook and Snapchat, publishing partners like Apple News and Yahoo, and messaging apps like WeChat. For some consumers, BuzzFeed is a digital newspaper. For others who find it on Snapchat, it is more like a TV company programming content for different cable networks. Content flows out, and information flows in. BuzzFeed uses its distribution channels to collect information on what audiences read, watch, and share, and turns these lessons into content for some other channel. Like Arthur Conan Doyle's famous description of the crime lord Moriarty, BuzzFeed is like a spider sitting at the center of a vast web, heeding the radiations of 1,000 threads. If we see something works well on Instagram, it can be adapted for Snapchat, founder and CEO Jonah Peretti once said. If we see something works well as a post, it can be adapted for video. If we see something works in the UK, it can be adapted for Australia. The nodes of the network are very autonomous, but they share learnings back with the larger network. The legacy of Kamen runs through Disney and BuzzFeed. It is total merchandising, an infinity hit loop in which everything is a test of and proof of concept for everything else. This is one vision of the future of hits. But there is another. The free distribution of the internet should also empower individuals, untethered from the old gatekeepers that once controlled distribution, marketing, and hitmaking. These individuals or small companies may not challenge Disney's domain, but they can achieve cultural renown and commercial success on their own terms by using the internet to build networks and reach audiences. They are not like empires, but rather like city-states. I met Ryan Leslie, rapper, hip-hop producer, network science nerd, and startup founder, in the financial district of Manhattan, the southern nub of the island where the shadows of tall buildings cut demented rhombuses of sunlight in the tiny streets. It was 10 a.m. when we met in the lobby of a giant luxury residential tower. Leslie had been up until 4 a.m. that morning at his studio a few blocks away, working on several new songs. His bottom teeth were encased in gold grill, and he was dressed in a long cotton t-shirt and light blue skinny jeans with holes in the knees. We rode the elevator to his floor and opened a heavy door to enter his screening room, with beige soundproof walls and several rows of matching beige chairs. Then, Leslie told me his life story. "My parents are Salvation Army officers, straight off the rip," he began. "When Ryan was born in 1978, his parents sent him to South America to live with his grandparents and the Salvation Army in Suriname. When he returned to the United States, the family moved constantly, but music anchored his home life. His mother sang and played piano, his father sang and played trumpet. Leslie attended four high schools in 3 years, in Richmond and Fredericksburg, Virginia, then to Daly City outside San Francisco and Stockton, California. By the age of 14, Leslie had nearly exhausted his high school slate of advanced courses, and a guidance counselor encouraged him to move on to community college in California. Leslie took the SATs. He scored a 1600. He applied for a Rotary International grant and gave a speech. "To do what you believe in, and believe in what you do, is the key to a life of fulfillment," he said, with perfect antimetaboly. He won the scholarship and applied to Stanford and Harvard. He chose Harvard. Leslie arrived at Cambridge, Massachusetts, as a 15-year-old freshman. Hoping to honor his parents' and grandparents' example of sacrifice, he was prepared to become a doctor. Then he discovered Stevie Wonder. That was that. Leslie had to be a musician. "My dad was confused," Leslie said. "My parents wanted to protect me from the personal and financial risks associated with pursuing a career with so many uncertainties that requires a stroke of luck and magic sprinkle dust." He was obsessive, performing in several separate singing groups like the Kumba Singers and the Harvard Crocodillos, and camped out in the Quad Sound Studios for all-nighters in the basement of the Forsheimer House to work on beats and lyrics. When he needed a cheap way to contact recording companies in Los Angeles, he took an ad sales job with the Harvard Guide and secretly made free long-distance phone calls to scouts and producers. Although his friends told him he was crazy and he spent much of college on academic probation, he graduated on time and delivered the commencement speech for Harvard's class of 1998. But unlike the cap-and-gown graduates in the audience, Leslie hadn't spent his senior year setting up post-grad jobs in the consulting, banking, or corporate corridors of the economy. He graduated from Harvard University with no job, no income, no savings, and no home. His most valuable possession was a working campus key that allowed him to sneak into vacant dorms over the summer to sleep and take showers. Leslie's early career was a series of false starts. He sold beats to gangs who wanted to anthologize their lives in rap songs and made so little money he had to live and record in a storage area behind a barbershop in Boston. Finally, a bit of magic sprinkle dust fell. At 24, on the verge of giving up and applying to law school, he was invited to participate in a one-month beat camp in the Bronx with the producer Young Lord. The internship led to an interview with Puff Daddy, who immediately recognized Leslie's prodigious talent and provided the money and stars to nurture it. Soon, he was writing beats for Beyoncé. Leslie signed a publishing deal with Universal Records for $500,000. He fell in love and started dating a young model, black, Filipino, Mexican, and atomically sexy, according to New York Magazine. Her name was Cassie. He wrote her a song that she could give to her mother, Me and You. When his label heard the track, they insisted on releasing it and turning Cassie into a star. The record was a commercial smash, selling more than a million digital downloads in half a year to become one of the biggest hip-hop songs of 2006. Critics hailed Cassie as the century's next Janet Jackson. But as quickly as everything seemed to come together, it all fell apart. Cassie started dating Puff Daddy, who now calls himself Diddy. Leslie released two solo albums and neither achieved blockbuster success. In 2010, he filed for bankruptcy. Leslie paused here. He had been talking for about an hour straight. He leaned back and looked up for a while as if the next part of the story were written on the ceiling. All I needed, he said, and stopped. He gathered the words and rapped a verse. All I needed was 5 racks to get up out of the projects. All I needed was some contacts, but I wasn't getting no callbacks. So I put it on my back. That's my grind and my time. So when I'm counting these millions, man, that's my money and my shine. Leslie was distraught by the economics of the music label business. For every dollar earned by a recording artist, the label often earns between 3 and 8 times more. As a result, labels are built to live on scale, even if its artists can make a meaningful living on niche. $1 million here and there won't make or break any label's year, but for an independent artist, $1 million would change somebody's life. Leslie doesn't belong to a label anymore. Instead, he built a smartphone application that helps him stay in closer touch with a smaller audience that pays him directly for his music. The app, called Superphone, is like an advanced messaging service. Leslie has given his direct phone number out to more than 40,000 people. He uses the app to text them directly when he has a new song, when he's performing, or even when he wants to invite them to a party. He sold out a New Year's Eve celebration in 2014 with $1,700 tickets and sold several copies of a special July 4th album for $5,000. In total, Leslie has 16,000 paying customers that he can contact on Superphone. He knows their names, their numbers, the music they've bought, and what they paid. The average contribution is around $100 per year. Less than 20,000 buyers is not nearly enough scale to become a major artist within the label system. But Leslie doesn't need a label. For an expense of about $3,000 in text messaging fees, he was able to generate $589,000 in 2014 without a label, manager, or marketing staff. Building Superphone has also taught Leslie about the mechanics of success, why some talented people make it, and why other talents fail. Leslie has the numbers of Kanye West and Ludacris on his phone. He has famous rappers, singers, and hip-hop producers in his pocket. An ordinary 22-year-old has none of that. Indeed, much of what initially seemed to him like magic sprinkle dust turned out to be real and quantifiable. So often, the difference between success and failure, he decided, was the quality of the people surrounding the artist. Take two young men with the same talent. One is a good-looking kid from the Great Plains with a great voice. His 5 closest friends are his parents and classmates. The second kid is from London, Canada. His top 5 includes Usher, one of the biggest pop stars in the world, and Scooter Braun, one of the biggest talent managers in music. The first kid is a gifted nobody. The second kid is Justin Bieber. The difference isn't the face or the falsetto. It's the quality of the top 5, the power of the network. The science snaps into the lyrics. All I needed was some contacts. I get chills thinking about this stuff, Leslie told me. If you want to be a pop star, you need a pop star's top 5. If you want to be a politician, you need a politician's top five. Your network needs to match the quality of Obama's inner circle, or Clinton's, or a Bush. If you want to be the best tennis player in the world, the five tennis people in your life have to be better than the five people around Serena Williams. Leslie was bouncing up and down on the couch and rubbing his arms from shoulder to elbow. Now I could see them, goosebumps on his forearms. "My thesis is simple," he said. "Your network is your power." Most hits bear the indelible imprint of not only their maker, but also some forgotten enabler along the way. Would I recognize a Monet painting if he had never met Manet, or Paul Durand Ruel, or Gustave Caillebotte? Could hundreds of millions of people around the world hum Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock if not for the music tastes of a California fifth grader, Peter Ford? There would be no 50 Shades without a fan fiction network, just as countless apps could not have achieved instant virality without piggybacking on networks of college campuses. I knew and loved Johannes Brahms' Lullaby, not only because of its economy of melody, but also because of a lineage of German Americans whose ancestors fled Europe at the right time. This cascade of musical influence bloomed out of Austria and Berlin, and its tendrils touched my mother's home in the suburbs of Detroit. I found myself mapping Ryan Leslie's observations onto the lessons of Duncan Watts, the rapper and chaos theorist. Artist versus scientist, growing up on opposite ends of the world, following divergent passions and goals, yet arriving at the same conclusion. Hits are morsels of meaning passed from one network to another, forged in the cluster of creators and delivered to a million little cults. None of this is new. From ancient lullabies to modern memes, new hits serve old purposes. To fill the time. To familiarize the strange. To estrange the familiar. To infect with emotion. To create meaning. What's different today is the means. The ability of small players like Leslie to amass large audiences. And the power of large companies like Disney to achieve global omniscience. Ryan Leslie is not the biggest rap star on the planet. He probably never will be. There is too much talent and too little listening time for each worthy artist, creator, or entrepreneur to claim a seat in the pantheon of stardom. So he forged another path. And now perhaps his most durable legacy won't be any one song, but an invention that allows artists to find paying audiences without interference from the old gatekeepers that once stood between them. Leslie doesn't know if his next thing is going to be a hit. Nobody can know that. To be a maker in this world is to sacrifice certainty for love at the altar of art. But it's that tantalizing uncertainty that keeps him up until 4 a.m. My grind and my time. That's all anybody can hope to control. The rest is magic sprinkle dust. This is Derek Thompson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2017 by Derek Thompson. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.